Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
That is correct. It is I, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, my friend. How are you? It is wonderful to be here talking to you again, and that is for many reasons. The number one reason being that I'm a little bit embarrassed to say it, but and I hope this doesn't freak you out, but I love you. That's the big reason I'm here, because I think I'm falling for you. I love all of my listeners here at UFO Think Tank Radio, and I love that you're here to listen and that you're enthusiastic and love this topic just like I do, which is just such a big inspiration to get this information out for you and to have wonderful guests such as our guest this evening. This guy flipping rocks, and that is Robert Powell. He is the Director of Research for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. He has been such for a while now. In fact, if you've been with the show for a while, you probably remember he was one of my first guests. And back when the Stephenville stuff went down, this is the guy who, along with Glenn Schultz, a radar expert, got FAA data to demonstrate that there was an unknown craft without a beacon identifier on it, in the area of Stephenville. Its flight characteristics were peculiar, to say the least, and the object was in areas where the witnesses said it was. Not all witnesses, but many of them. So it corroborated a lot of the witness testimony. And, of course, Stephenville was on this Chasing UFOs TV show thing that they're doing on the National Geographic Channel. So I had him on, but really that's not the main topic that me and Robert are talking about here tonight. Really, a large part of what we're talking about also is this incredible book that he's been working on with some other researchers. And this book is on the history of UFOs. You might be saying, well, that's pretty boring. But this one is special because, the person he wrote it with, it's kind of exciting. And this is Michael Swords, who is a scientist. And at the Western Michigan University, and he's a professor of natural sciences, and many other researchers. Maybe I'll read off the list a little later. However, the point being that what they did is they went and found a lot of government documents. So this is mostly U.S., but also other governments. And so this tells a story as far as U.S. government documents. And I'm not talking about, some of the more dubious documents of unknown origins, like anonymously leaked documents. I'm talking about documents that have been found via FOIA requests or documents they went and found themselves in universities at various libraries throughout the country, or documents that other researchers had found or discovered on their own. So that's really exciting because there are a lot of files out there that are surprising. You know, we hear about these stories of these guys in the military having sightings, chasing UFOs, being told to shoot at UFOs. We've heard some of these stories. So they went and found documentation of these cases, and these are government documents demonstrating that how serious that this phenomena is taken by the military. So I think this is going to be a very significant book. It includes something, I think he says, like over 200 pages of photos. It's a very big book, 500 plus pages long. So I'm excited about this book, and that's why I wanted to have Robert on to talk some more about it. Plus, I hadn't had him on the show in a while. He's a great guy, so this will be a lot of fun. So we got good stuff. Speaking of course, exciting things that I like to do for you all and for the greater community here on the planet Earth. That's right. It's interplanetary in scope, at least my intentions and towards helping out, you know, all humans and whoever's visiting. I don't discriminate if there's people from other cosmoses, cosmosi, other places other than Earth. That's cool with me, man. Welcome. The more the merrier. Just come say hi and, you know, let me in on what's going down. But my point here being that, of course, as you know, I've got the conference going on, Cosmic Exploration Conference. We have scientists and professors discussing space mysteries and UFOs. And I'll tell you what, that we do have a couple people, well, and I, you know, a couple means two, and I'm not even sure that we have that many, that are skeptical when it comes to the UFO phenomena. That demonstrates, and I have more than a couple scientists. I'm like half of the speakers have PhDs and or are professors or scientists. So this demonstrates, you know, what I've been saying for a long time. Scientists are interested in all of this stuff. And so we'll get them together to talk and, you know, get some insight. And I think what it's shaping up to be is that the special perspective that is going to be given at this conference is not so much if the phenomena exists, if there is extraterrestrial life. However, how will we react when we discover officially extraterrestrial life, and when we, and this isn't me talking this when we stuff, this is, you know, these guys, these people who are speaking, when we discover intelligent civilizations out there and how we would react. And these are sociologists and psychologists, very qualified people to be speaking on the subject. And I think it's going to be particularly special environment that will we have this academic space, this academic environment to discuss this topic in a very serious manner. So I feel that this is going to be, and I've been going to conferences for a while. I've helped put on conferences. But this one in particular, I'm excited about because I think it's going to be very unique and historically significant looking back, especially when, since, I think we're right around the corner for at least discovery of some sort of life. So very exciting stuff. I hope you come and join us. If you can't join us, there's also a Kickstarter. If you go to cosmicex.com or if you go to ufodaily.com, there's a Kickstarter just for the month of July, and this is for me to raise money. So if you can't come, that you can get a DVD. So you can go to this Kickstarter. You can go to ufodailynews.com. You'll see it there on the right-hand side, the Kickstarter project. You can purchase DVDs through this Kickstarter at a very low price, and that helps me gain the funding so that hopefully I can get the equipment to make DVDs. So, and I've also had some offers for people who want to help, and thank you very much, and we'll definitely be in contact. So that's some that's going on with the conference, and I've been so dang busy, I haven't really gotten a whole lot of stories. Well, I haven't. Yeah, stories up on UFODailyNews.com. However, I have kept up with the news feed. So I'm sending out UFO news, like I say, on a regular basis. And if you go to the news feed link there, you're going to see tons and tons of stories from the mainstream press. So check that out. And in fact, you know, I'm going to go over these stories in just a second, as we usually do on the show. And a couple of these stories have some videos that are kind of fun, or at least some good stories here. So I'll get those up soon. Okay, I promise you all. at UFO Daily News. Otherwise, you can go to the site and see them there. But one of the things I want to talk about is getting into UFO news. Should I, and you can email me a couple of things. If you're listening right now and I see your email before the end of the show, I will then refer to them at the end of the show. However, here's a couple, and if you're not listening live, like 90% of you, you're listening on your podcast or your Google Play or some other way, email me anyways. I want to know two things. What you think of the Chasing UFO show from National Geographic. I'm having a hard time getting a bead on what people think, although, yeah, I'd have to say, like our guest last week, I have heard some criticism, but maybe you like it. Let me know. I don't know, because I'm on it with my good buddy Jason McClellan on the 20th, and I hope that at least people like that episode, or at least like my part and Jason's part. Jason's always a lot of fun. But anyway, I want to hear your thoughts on that, and I also want to hear... This all started with the other thing that I really wanted to hear from you all, which just the Chasing UFO thing, because I can't remember the other. I already forgot it. So, yeah, send me some info and let me know what you think. And the email address, you could use just Alejandro, A-L-E-J-A-N-D-R-O, or info, I-N-F-O, at UFODailyNews.com. And that'll be great, because I want to hear your thoughts there. So you can only imagine my thoughts. Oh, here's the other one. Do you think I should make some, like, UFO news music to transition into UFO news? Nothing too, you know, wacky or silly, but just would that be nice, do you think? Speaking of UFO news, we used to have this funny little guy named Jason McClellan on the show doing that with me when I worked for Open Minds. He is currently working for Open Minds now. And I don't want... I'll put it this way. If you want him to be back on the show like I do, ask Open Minds. He's got to get permission to do that. And so send them an email, and hopefully he'll be back on the show. But he's doing his own little web series with the lovely Maureen Ellsbury. And if you've seen her, well, many people comment on the lovely Maureen. And what's so funny about this is that when I stopped working for Open Minds, somebody in an email said, oh, man, I could tell there was some tension there. No, there's no tension. There's only love. I love those guys. They're my buddies. No tension between Jason and Maureen and I. We're all very good friends, and I still keep in contact with them. So why am I talking about him? You're like, okay, what is he going on about Jason Maureen for, this little love fest here? It's because Lee Spiegel, our speaker from our guest from last week, he wrote a story about Jason and Maureen in their web series Spacing Out, where they do some news about space and UFOs and a short little segment that they put up on YouTube. That's my point. You can imagine my surprise. He didn't even tell me he was doing this. When on July 4th, I look at Huffington Post Weird News just to check up, and there's my two buddies right there. Big picture of them smiling away. Freaked me out. So, pretty cool that he did that, so you can check that out. However, there's another story that Mr. Lee Spiegel has done in the last week. And in fact, this just popped up yesterday. He did a special interview with Chase Brandon, a 35-year CIA veteran. I told you a little bit about this story before, because this gentleman was on Coast to Coast, and my buddy Robbie Graham from Silver Screen Saucers, he ran a story on this. And in fact, he sent me a story on this to post on my site, so I'll have it up soon. And about this Chase Brandon guy, the CIA veteran. He was real excited about it. No wonder why. So Lee had also caught him on Coast to Coast and had scheduled an interview and also did his own research into this guy. So I talked to Lee pretty regularly, and we talked in depth about this guy. And Lee did a lot of research. He found, you know, this guy certainly did work for the CIA. He had the unique position for a while of being an entertainment liaison. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. I would love to find out more. He has written a book on Roswell that is science fiction. That is not true. However, on Coast to Coast and now with Lee, he has confirmed that, yes, I do believe there were aliens that had crashed to Earth in an alien spacecraft in Roswell. He says he believes this because when he was at a place, it's kind of a historical archive for the CIA. He says it's nothing like the Indiana Jones warehouses, and that's what it feels like when he talks about that. But it's really just these smaller cardboard boxes, and he used to visit this place often and do research for various different things. And one day he ran across a box simply labeled Roswell. He opened the box and he saw pictures and other things. He doesn't describe them in detail, unfortunately, which I'm not sure why he doesn't do that. It'd be nice if he did. But all he'll say is that these pictures did confirm to me that this crash in Roswell was real, was extraterrestrial, and there were cadavers recovered. Pretty interesting news. If this guy is making it up, well, and I mean, you can speculate that he's making it up to sell books, but some people think, you know, he's been in the CIA so long, why would he hurt his credibility? Why would he do that? Of course, books equals money. But still, he really was in the CIA, so it's very intriguing. It kind of reminds me of Colonel Corso, of course, another very credible person who was a colonel in the Army and worked at the Pentagon, and he said he had worked with pieces from Roswell. He was given this box full of pieces, and they said, hey, this stuff's from Roswell, figure out what we do with it. Well, he's working at the Pentagon. So another very high-level witness who has come forth and is very no bones about it. Yep, there were extraterrestrials in Roswell, and I know this because in my work at the CIA, I saw the evidence. Hopefully we can get him on the show, and I will ask him some more details and questions about all of this. But a very, very interesting story indeed. And in fact, it's so interesting that Fox News picked it up today. So did the Daily Mail out in the UK. And I'm sure probably more will. So it looks like this story is going to go viral. Very interesting. Speaking of the videos, real quick here so we can get into the interview. That I mentioned earlier, there is a teen in New Freedom and York County, Pennsylvania, who took a video. Now, the video is kind of, it's just with his phone. It's a blinking light, but it's kind of interesting. He's a 19-year-old physics major at Duquesne University, an Eagle Scout, and he saw this video. He wrote a sci-fi novel when he's 15, and this thing looks very professional. He's a very, it seems like a very intelligent kid, you know, and he says he saw some strange lights flying around. He caught them on video on his phone, but of course the resolution is so poor you can't really tell much. But it's an interesting story that the news ran on this young gentleman. Also, on June 21st, a surfer captures a UFO on video, and this is in Australia. And this is interesting because it is about a 10-minute video, and it is this orangish-reddish looking light that is kind of flickering, which would make me think that perhaps it is a Chinese lantern. However, you know, those things don't last, at least when I've messed with them. They only last 10, 15 minutes, so kind of an interesting story, but this guy, when he saw it, him and his friends were very convinced that it was something abnormal, possibly a plasma ball, But he thinks most likely it was an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Very interesting. Speaking of extraterrestrial stories, there is a scientist, you might have read this, who speculates that aliens may look like jellyfish. He says most likely they do. That in a lot of these atmospheres that are much thicker, for example, he says a methane atmosphere, these things could float around scooping up chemicals and nutrients into their big gaping mouths. And of course, this made a lot of news, this theory about these jellyfish. Here's a story I really liked, and this was in Montana, the Lake County Leader. And this guy was writing about UFOs, a lot of stories on National Geographic and ABC News. And he wrote about, but did you know about the UFOs seen in Montana in the summer of 1966? He continues to write, his name is Paul Fugelberg, about these sightings in 1966 from late June to late July that he covered. He's a reporter and he wrote about them. He says he complained in his article that he hadn't seen any of these alleged UFOs. Then, that night, he saw one. He saw one of these things. He said it was too low and too fast to be a satellite. He happened to run to grab his camera and was able to snap a picture. And he's got this picture. It is of low resolution, but he's got it posted on his story here. And you see this bright light looks like it's over a pole. There's some electrical wires going by and a tree and a cloud up there. And you see this very bright light. So very interesting story. This reporter saying, hey, you know, I seen a UFO too. I wrote about them in the 60s. And then I saw one of those suckers. And he's pretty much saying, hey, have you seen one of these? Let me know. So very interesting. This is in the Lake County Leader. And, well, that's about the most recent really interesting news that we've had. So remember, you can find all of this at UFODailyNews.com. If you go to the UFO news feed, you're going to find links to all of these stories. And then soon here in the next few days, I'll get this story up from my buddy Robbie Graham on the Chase Brandon thing, but you can go to the Huffington Post Weird News to see that. And then I will also get up these video stories because these videos are interesting. However, for now, let's talk to my buddy Robert Powell. All right, I am happy to be speaking with a good MUFON buddy of mine, Robert Powell. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Alejandro. It's great to talk to you again. I'm glad you're our public relations director at MUFON now.
Yeah, it's good to be back because, you know, it was a lot of fun working with you back in those days. And so I'm happy to be back. Those were good times.
They were. I enjoyed them a lot.
Mm-hmm. And one of the good times was related to Stephenville. And I wanted to talk about this just for a minute because you did some incredible work, you with Glenn Schultz, and also because it was on the television show Chasing UFOs recently, so some people probably saw that who are listening. So in the Stephenville craziness, you know, one of the things that was great, which, you know, was a seminal piece of, I think, MUFON work overall, is that you with Glenn Schultz, a radar expert, were able to grab some data from the FAA to demonstrate that there was an anomalous object in the area and that some of the witness testimony was corroborated by the data you had found.
Yeah, we were fortunate in being able to get that data from the FAA. And what was really nice is to have so many witnesses over such a geographic area that was spread out, and these witnesses were seeing these objects at different times, but all during that same evening. And so that really made it worthwhile to go get the radar data because we had good witnesses to correlate it to. And probably, to me, the most interesting one of all was the constable who had seen the object just south of his home. He estimated 2 miles, and on radar, we picked up an object roughly 2 miles south of his home at the time that he saw this object.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really exciting to see that.
Well, and the data you had showed that it was moving extremely slow at times, possibly very fast at times, and also you were able to track the jets that were in the area, because there really were jets doing an exercise nearby.
Yeah, actually, that was the very first thing we did before we went looking for any unidentified objects in the radar data. The first thing we did was we tracked the jets through the entire 4 hours we had that information. So that way we knew where the jets were at all moments in time. And once we got them nailed down, then we went looking for objects that did not have transponder identifications. And we matched those up with the witnesses.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, you even the jets went out to the exercise area, returned to the base. However, one of those jets made a detour near where the sightings were. Is that correct?
That's right. You remember pretty well. There was a pair of jets for people who are familiar with geography, this will hit them right away, especially the geography of Oklahoma and Texas. But the Dallas-Fort Worth area is in far north Texas, almost at the Oklahoma border. Well, two of these jets head to the northwest, and they travel probably about 100 to 120 miles, and they're doing exercises basically due west of Oklahoma City. Well, when they're done with their exercises, they don't go back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, to what we used to be called Carswell Air Force Base. Go back there. They actually go due south and travel halfway into Texas, into the area where Stephenville and Comanche and Dublin are located. And they don't do any exercises in the military operating area there. They just fly south, fly over those cities, and then head back to their home base. So it's almost like someone said, why don't you guys go down there and check out what's going on?
Was this during the time of the sightings or soon after?
This was soon after most of the sightings occurred. The first two waves of jets, there were four in each squadron, had already gone down in, had been in the Stephenville area and were returning, and were either almost back to Dallas-Fort Worth or had already returned at the point in time that the two jets in Oklahoma came down due south.
Wow. Yeah, so that's really interesting. And here again, corroborates witness testimony of saying they saw jets after this anomalous object.
Yeah.
Afterwards, not chasing, I don't
right,
mean.
Right,
like,
exactly. That's yeah. What, yeah, you got that right. They weren't chasing after the UFO, but they saw the jets later on.
Right. So interesting data. And then real quick on the movement of the craft, the unknown object that you all had found in the radar data. Was that correct? It moved really slow, and I think there was a gap which could indicate fast speed, but perhaps, but at least there was for the most part, a consistent pattern of this thing moving straight.
Yeah, well, there's, we picked up this object 3 different times, and the one time when we picked it up southwest of the constable's home, he's the one who describes the whole series of lights that were dancing around, and then they came together and then just took off at an extremely high rate of speed towards Dublin, which was just north of his home. What was interesting is the object that was just south of his home that was barely moving, all of a sudden the next radar blip that we got was clear up north into the Dublin area. And you can calculate the speed at which it moves. And the speed it moved at was 1,900 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of corroborates what the constable said he saw. And then what you're referring to, that straight line, that was that path that was headed towards Crawford Ranch, where we had over 140 radar hits on that object. and at times it would not move. And then there were times where within a 10-second time span, it went from basically not moving to 540, 550 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Which is faster than at least, well, even like a commercial jet would fly, right? Or and maybe not as fast as a military jet, but of course those things you were able to track because they had transponders.
Well, yeah, right. The jets, the lead jets we could track because they had transponders. But for any object to go from basically a standstill to over 500 miles an hour in 10 seconds, that's a very high rate of acceleration. And then to make it even more interesting, 10 seconds later, it had deaccelerated down to like 30 or 40 miles an hour.
Wow. And then you lost track of it near, it was headed towards the Crawford Ranch, but lost track of it because of the data was only for a set period of time.
Right. We just have 4 hours of data, and our data ended at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. And at that point in time, the object was about 5 to 6 miles from Crawford Ranch, but it was on a straight line there. So I'm sure within another 10 minutes, it would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And what, one thing that wasn't in the original report, Alejandro, is about 6 months later, I identified two witnesses, and I went and talked to them. They lived a mile and a half from Crawford Ranch. And that evening, they were riding their bikes. It was a husband and wife. And they saw an object because they could see Crawford Ranch from their home. And they saw an object they described as like taking about six Jupiters, so six very bright nighttime objects, and just lining them up horizontally. So it had a lot more width than Jupiter has, but that level of brightness. And it was slowly descending. And then they said the next thing, it just made a 90-degree turn and moved parallel to the ground and was gone in, they said, roughly a blink of an eye.
Hmm. Wow. Now, you've said that since... Oh, and, you know, I just like to throw this in here because I think it was interesting and I like to, you know, give credit where credit's due, but startlingly, for me, there was so little attention given to your report because, well, at the time, you know, I was doing the PR like we talked about, and I was working with all of these media to make sure they were getting interviews with our guys in Texas and everything and making sure all the stories had MUFON on them, you know, that were talking about Stephenville because it was such a big story. And in fact, it was our investigators going to putting together this meeting in Dublin where they said, you know, these UFO researchers are descending on Dublin. And it turned out, you know, there was more media and more camera than there were investigators or witnesses. But, you know, afterwards, I had sent the report to, or at least the press release and some information to the AP lady who broke the story and made it big in the first place. And I know she wrote something, it wasn't very big, and a couple of other places kind of mentioned it, but it didn't get that much attention. And really, the most attention it got was on Larry King when you were able to be on there with Glenn. And that was in thanks largely to Angela Joyner, the reporter down there in Stephenville. Or was she Dublin? No, she was Stephenville.
She was in Stephenville, yeah.
Yeah. And she was the one who broke the story, and you know, Larry King was doing a whole episode on this and UFOs, and she was the one who really told him, you got to have, you know, these MUFON guys on, you got to have Robert Powell on and Glenn, because they did this incredible radar study, and thanks to her, we got on there, or you got on there.
Yeah, and at that, you know, at about that same time, to give your audience kind of a feel for the time frame, this event occurred on January 8th of 2008. The big meeting in Dublin was on January 19th, and that's when all the press came. And it really hit the national wire and news during that week, which was, you know, getting towards the latter part of January. Well, it took us, took Glenn and I until late June, early July to complete all of the analysis of that radar data. It wasn't something we could just rapidly do. Well, at that point in time, you sent out a bunch of, you know, information to try to get attention from the national media, and Angela Joyner did also. She sent out, I think, multiple packets to different media organizations, and there was really no interest in it, mostly because I think they were excited because of what happened in January, but by the time June or July rolled around, you know, they weren't excited about a radar report.
True. And luckily, Larry King was going to cover it. He was doing a lot of UFO stuff around that time. So luckily, he was going to do his special on it. So we were at least able to get some recognition for
that.
Because I think that was a really important study.
It was good. And that was the Larry King show where he had Seth from SETI mm-hmm. on. Seth Shostak was on.
And you know what's funny about the debates on that episode and on the show was that the pro-UFO guys and the skeptics like Shostak, they really weren't too far apart. And it's unfortunate that sometimes people think they have to take a oppositional type of stance. Where everything isn't always a debate. You can agree. It's okay to agree on some things and to point out when you agree. And, I mean, they were not really discounting your work at all. They were just saying, you know, there could be other answers. But and that's a fair perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And that is what Seth said. He did not make any arguments against the work that Glenn and I did. He just said, well, maybe there were some other explanations. And he didn't really have any viable explanations. He was, you know, just saying, well, maybe something else caused it.
Right. And so in the aftermath, I mean, since, have there been any new developments or any new information or discovery that way?
No, on the Stephenville case, there hasn't been any. The one thing that's interesting is that ever since that case, the FAA no longer will allow us to have their raw radar data. And the reason they give now is that they say it's a threat to the national airways to give that information out. So the only type of radar data you can get from them now is it's basically a type of radar data that's been filtered through their algorithms. But you cannot get their raw data. It's what the raw data is what they call ERIT, E-R-I-T data.
Mm-hmm. And they probably, do you think they really thought you guys, what they were going to do? Because what this data is right, a lot of single data points, like tons and tons of pieces of information that you have to painstakingly analyze and put together. It's not an easy process. So I wonder if they even thought you would do this work.
No, yeah, I don't think so. I don't think they had any idea we would. And then probably what got them concerned, you know, possibly more than anything else, is that in the report we identify the locations of all the F-16s, where they went, when they left, when they came back, where they were in relation to the witnesses. So that may have been a concern to them. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. So interesting, and you said you're working with someone now though to animate the.
There's a guy in North Carolina by the name of Russ Tidall, and he's a computer programmer, and I worked with him, and he wrote a program that basically allows me to put in the radar data, and then you get a visual animation of a radar screen. And you see where the radar site is. You can see the jets coming in. You can see the unknown object moving. I did that because for most audiences, seeing something like that is more meaningful to them than the original Excel files that Glenn and
right.
I created.
That is very cool. And when will that be done?
I've already completed some of it already. I bet... Russ has he's finished his program, and I entered in the Stephenville data, and so you can actually see it in real time as you look at the radar screen.
How cool. That's really cool. And how do people see that, or is there the ability for the public to see that yet?
I have not put it on YouTube or done anything like that. Maybe I should. I have presented it a couple of times, once at a conference that I was with Angela up in near the DFW area, Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then one in San Antonio at a conference there I presented it.
How cool. That is so cool. Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'll show it to you. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right. Well, moving on from Stephenville, you know, thanks for the update and the overview on that. Just wanted to cover it because of the chasing UFOs, which, speaking of which, I don't think they covered the radar data either. I know they interviewed Angela Joyner, but I think you said you weren't able to catch the episode, so you're not fully versed on everything on it, but you know you weren't on it.
Right.
That's the one thing you know for sure.
I know that.
Which is too bad, because that would have been a great piece if they would have had the information on the radar. Hopefully, you know, Angela talked about it, and they covered that. But another reason, or another interesting development, is this book that you and others have been working on for a couple years now that I have been anxiously anticipating and so excited to get my hands on. And that's a book called UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry. Maybe you could talk about some of the other people who worked on this book and how you compiled this.
Okay, yeah, I would be glad to, Alejandro. Let me say first, the goal of this book was not your typical UFO book. The goal is for it to be an actual historical book with facts, endnotes, bibliographies. It's a it's like a great reference book on UFOs and government. And we try to be as factual as we can throughout the book. The and we've got some great authors. It took us over 4.5 years to finish this.
Wow.
We met together as a team. You know, we broke out and did various parts of the various chapters. We have over 200 photographs in the book, so it's a it's really a great book, if I can say so. Some of the authors was Michael Swords. He was probably our primary author. And Mike is a professor out of Michigan. I think it's – I don't recall if it was Eastern Michigan University that he's a professor at. But Mike is a great historian. And he has a PhD and has done great work in that area. He has got a room. I went to his home. He's got a room the size of my living room that is solid, books, file cabinets. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
And then there's myself as an author. We have Klaus Svahn, who was one of the premier researchers of UFOs in the country of Sweden. And then Vicente Juan Ballester Olmos, who's a Spanish researcher. Bill Chalker, you probably have heard of Bill. He's out of Australia. And then, of course, Barry Greenwood. He's in the U.S., but Barry's a lot of people are familiar with Barry. Richard Thiem, who actually gives conferences all over the world. He goes to hacker conferences.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he talks to hacker conferences about kind of the world behind everything.
Hmm.
Jan Aldrich, who has probably done more research at the National Archives and University Archives than anyone alive today, and Steve Purcell, and Steve, I believe, used to be the state director of Tennessee for MUFON, and Steve also has a historian bent to him, and together all of us put this book of 580 pages together.
How cool. I mean, that is just really exciting. And I mean, what you based it off of, right, was it was Is it purely based off of documents?
Yes, it is purely based off of government documents, either FOIA documents, all the types of government documents we could get our hands on, back up everything that we have in the book.
But, and I should note, documents that have solid, what is the word I'm thinking of here? The credibility is very high, in which you know that these are government documents.
Right, right. These are government documents where it's not, where there's no doubt about the document.
Mm-hmm.
So the, you know, these are all clear cut, like the Bollinger Memo. They're all documents like that.
Provenance. That's what I'm thinking of. So,
and we have, I would say we probably have over 1,000 references throughout the book.
Wow.
Because every chapter has on average, I'd say around 40 to 50 endnotes where we reference. There's endnotes throughout the book. So you can see whenever we make a statement that requires documentation, it's in the book. So there's a lot of original sources in here.
How cool. I mean, this is just so exciting. So many people working on such an important effort. And that's what I mean. I mean, it's how, like you said, a great reference and for solid, solid information that is essentially, I mean, it's not just, you know, like the MJ-12 documents where a lot of their provenance is under question because they're allegedly leaked documents. These are documents that come from, you know the source, and the source is certainly government, where they're indisputable.
Right. Yeah, these aren't ones that I've ever heard anyone make arguments about.
Mm-hmm. But they're still exciting information, right? I mean, how far does it go back?
We start with World War II, mm-hmm. and the Foo Fighters, and we really weave a story of history and how the government originally reacted. I mean, in the beginning, when U.S. pilots were seeing these balls of light in the European theater as well as the Pacific theater, but more in the European theater, the U.S. government's first thought was, is this some new type of Nazi or Japanese weapon? Maybe some type of surveillance system.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the war was over, the U.S. government sent scientists to Germany and to Japan and interviewed their scientists to try to figure out what were those. Was this some new weapon they had that we want to get our hands on? And the response we got from the Germans was, we thought it was yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so that begins the story. And from there it goes into the ghost rocket episodes that occurred in the Scandinavian countries immediately after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the thought there was, well, somehow the Russians, the Soviets, who had obtained Nazi knowledge, because, right, the United States and Russia, we were, and of course then it was Soviet Union more than Russia. We didn't really call it Russia. Both countries were trying to steal all the Nazi scientists they could get. And a lot of people don't know that, but that's how the United States and Soviet Union developed their space programs,
mm-hmm.
was by getting Nazi scientists. So that was a concern when the ghost rockets started. They call them the ghost rockets back in 1946. So we talk about that, and we go through the evidence, you know, that exists, how the United States government reacted to it. We then go into 1947, where we're seeing them, where we first started seeing them in the United States, like with Kenneth Arnold and other episodes besides just him. And the first stop with the U.S. was, okay, the Soviets have figured something out from their Nazi scientists, and these may be Soviet, you know, reconnaissance systems of some type. And that went up the chain of command, clear to the Pentagon. So some people think that the military never really, you know, concerned themselves with UFOs. That's the farthest from the truth. when this first happened, it was a national security issue. They had to find out what they were. And like I said, their first thought was Soviet. And then once they figured it wasn't Soviet, it turned to a team called SIGN, S-I-G-N, that was assigned, no pun intended, but had the job to figure out what were these. And that's an interesting case where the officers and scientists involved in that program considered an extraterrestrial hypothesis as a possibility. They didn't say that's what it was, but what they did say was it wasn't Soviet. And they said it's a physical reality. It physically exists. It has shape. It shows up on radar. You know, we've had reliable people identify these objects. And so they said one possibility is that it comes from outside of the Earth. Well, when they that and that was what they called their estimate. And in the military, that's what they usually do when you're trying to figure something out. They order an estimate. So their estimate went up the flagpole, and when it got up to the Pentagon, the reply came back, no, we're not going to say anything like that at all. And then they eliminated that estimate, and to this day, no one has gotten a copy of it. There are people such as Al Chop, a guy who was in the Air Force back in the 40s and 50s, who says he saw the estimate, but it's not available. You can't get your hands on it. So what did happen is they wrote a new estimate, and the new estimate took out the part about any possibility of it being extraterrestrial. And we go from there, and the, you know, the book goes all the way up until modern times, like Phoenix Lights and Stephenville.
Now, did you grab some insight into in these documents? And I know Rupert.
Rupelt?
Yeah, Rupelt, you know, kind of you in his book, when he was running the Blue Book, you can kind of see this. But did you get a strong feeling as to where and how things changed from taking this phenomena as a serious investigation to kind of pushing it under the rug, or kind of a hot potato that we don't want to deal with this anymore?
Right. It kind of started in the early 50s, especially in 1952, when all, you know, when there was the General Samford had his conference in Washington, D.C., because there were all these UFOs over the Capitol, and they were showing up on radar there, and the Congress was getting involved. President Truman was involved, and it was like, okay, what's going on? And basically, the Air Force couldn't explain, you know, what was going on. And so once all that dust settled down, they put together a panel called the Robertson Panel, and that was a panel of scientists. But when you go and you read the documents and just read what these guys talked about, it's like, these guys get together and they're like, well, I don't really have time to be here. I've got to be somewhere else. How long will this take us to get this resolved? And you can tell there's not a whole lot of interest in it. But they do spend some time. And after a few weeks of effort go by, and they meet with the CIA, they meet with the Air Force, and they come out with some recommendations, and probably the key recommendation they have is that this is not a national security issue, which was probably, that's a true statement for the information they had.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other statement they have is, but it could be a national security issue in terms of the American populace gets excited about these, they clog up the phone lines, and should there ever be if the Soviets were to use something like this to divert our attention, it could be a national security issue. So one of their decisions was, well, we need to educate the public that there is no such, there's nothing to this, so that we can eliminate In other words, they're saying the objects themselves aren't a national security issue, only the people's fascination with them. If we can eliminate that, then we eliminate the only true national security issue that we think exists.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they put together programs where they wanted to educate the public and to kind of poo-poo the whole concept of flying saucers or UFOs.
Now, their logic, if I'm not mistaken, is that to this idea that they're not a national security threat, is that they hadn't seen any evidence of this phenomena being aggressive or posing a threat.
That's correct. They had not seen, in all the documents we ever saw, we never saw one that established, you know, for sure that these were ever a threat, mm-hmm. that UFOs were ever a threat.
So do you think they considered that, you know, it's a real phenomena and it's just that at least, you know, not posing a threat, it's their, whatever it is, it's not coming and trying to down our planes, so it is something benign? And do you think that's their sense, or do you think they felt maybe it was a mythology, and in that case, then it's something.
You know, when you read all the documents and you go back into that era of history, I think what happened was the Air Force did all they could to try to figure out, okay, what is this, and is this a national security issue? And once they decided the answer was no, it's not a national security issue, but we don't have any idea what it is, right? So then it became an issue of, okay, we don't know what it is, it's not national security, but we can't, right? If you put yourself in their shoes, you can't go to the public or Congress and say, you know, it's not a national security issue, but I have no idea what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would just be constantly hounded.
Right.
So that's when I believe they decided, okay, we need to get this, you know, sweep it under the rug, get it off our shoulders. You know, we don't want to deal with it.
And
that's when that started.
And it seems that's been the policy ever since.
It changed a little. You know, we had Project Blue Book after Project Grudge, and then the Colorado Committee, which its purpose was to squash and get rid of Project Blue Book, because after they got rid of it, then the policy seemed to have shifted a little more, basically just total ignoring it in terms of the public. In other words, you don't comment at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at history after 1969, it was very unusual that you ever got a comment regarding UFOs by the Air Force. In the 50s and 60s, you always got comments. Every time there was a major sighting, the Air Force would come out and say, you know, they'd say, okay, no, we don't think it's this, or we think it's something else. But they always would comment. Once you pass 69, those comments stop. And every once in a while, there's exceptions. Mm-hmm. But in general, that's what happens. And one of the exceptions was Stephenville. When Angela Joyner called that major at Carswell, if he had done what other Air Force officials had been doing for the last 40 years, he would have just said, we don't know anything about UFOs, and we don't, you know, report on that. That was taken care of in 1969 with the Colorado Project. And that would have been the end of the story. But this guy was a little more kind of a talkative kind of guy, according to Angela. You know, he was actually a fun guy to talk to when she first talked to him. And so he started saying, well, I'll check on it. No, we don't have any airplanes. And, well, maybe it was the sun glinting off a plane. And, you know, he started kicking these ideas around. And then when it turned out that there had been planes in the air, and she finally called him back, he wasn't his boisterous self anymore. She said all he would say was, I'm sorry, Miss Joyner, but all I can say is, and then he would read off this piece of paper that say, you know, we don't know anything about this, blah, blah, blah. We made a mistake about the planes. and that's all he would say. And she would ask him again, "Oh, come on, no, you were, you know, you told me before." And he'd go, "I'm sorry, Miss Joyner, this is all I can say."
Mm-hmm.
And so he obviously got in a lot of trouble. If he had just done what they normally do, he would have been okay, because he would have just not commented any at all.
Right. And he was saying due to a clerical error, you know, I think.
Yeah.
But there were planes in the area. And now this is prior to you all coming out with your findings. Do you think that prompted him, since you, with your radar data, you were going to be able to establish that there were military exercises in the area?
You know, that's hard to say, mm-hmm. You know, especially when you're dealing with a bureaucracy.
Right.
I mean, they may have made a mistake and finally figured out that, you know, their error, and were, would have told the error independent of us having the radar data.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's possible they knew radar data had been given out and that someone might figure it out. So, but, you know, it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, you know, going back to the Robertson panel and then later the Colorado Project, you know, in researching this and reading the documents, for example, Mike Swords and I went down to Texas A&M University in College Station, where some of the documents from the Colorado Project are still exist. And they exist in the papers of a guy by the name of Roy Craig. Roy Craig, towards the latter part of the Colorado Project, became basically Condon's main guy after he fired a couple of other guys that he had there. And what becomes real clear for anyone who's dealt with scientists as to what happened was this. You've got the head guy, Condon, and he's not really interested in this project at all. He only did it as a favor, because he had a lot of friends in government offices. So he did it as a favor. And basically, these scientists were underneath him. They went off and tried to figure things out. And if anyone reads the whole 1,000-page Colorado Project, you'll see some of those guys said, "Hey, there's things here we can't explain."
Mm-hmm.
And they're not terrestrial. There's just no explanation for them. You know, it's some unknown phenomenon or whatever. Well, once Condon comes back and, you know, it's getting time to come out with the report, you know, he's upset that some of these guys are thinking that, oh, maybe there's something to UFOs. So he puts the squash to that real quick, and a couple of guys get fired. He basically writes the summary report, and if you read the whole document, the summary report doesn't reflect what the rest of the document says.
Right, and lots of people have said it's as if he wrote that summary without even reading the rest of the document, which is, some of these guys suggest, is entirely possible.
Oh, yeah, I don't think he did read it. And the amazing thing is the National Academy of Sciences came out and endorsed his summary of it. So obviously those guys
right.
did the entire article. And the thing is, when I went through Roy Craig's notes and everything, and because I've worked with a lot of PhDs when I was in the semiconductor field, and it's real typical. It's like he's got this job and he's doing it, and he hits a barrier, right? Like sometimes the Air Force wouldn't give him information. Well, he bounces off the wall. He didn't try to go back through the wall. He doesn't go try to get someone to, you know, push the Air Force to why they won't give him information. Like there was a case at Edwards Air Force Base, and he was trying to investigate it, and they just said, "No, we don't have anything." And so he just ended it right there. He didn't go any farther.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy, and there's a tape recording on this. This is a Boeing engineer who was working as a radar technician for the Army, stationed at a Army Air Corps base in New Jersey during about 1952. So actually it would have been Air Force, not Army Air Corps, by 52. So he was stationed, as a radar operator, and this was when all these UFO sightings near Washington, D.C. were occurring. Well, they were getting constant objects on their radar, and they were sending up F-85s. Well, so Condon interviews this guy, and he tells – Roy Craig interviews him, and he tells Roy Craig and on the tape, he says, "We received orders that came straight down from the Pentagon that we were to fire on one of these objects." And he said, "We had our 90-millimeter cannon tied to our radar, and the F-85s were loaded with their missiles and with their light machine gun or light cannon to fire on the objects." He said one of the F-85s was closing in on the object and was ready to fire, and then the object just disappeared off his screen. It just like zipped off, gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, right, here's a guy who's supposed to be investigating in the Colorado Project. He gets a report like that. What is, in his notes, he asks the Boeing engineer, "Can you give me any more information on that? Send me a letter." Well, the guy doesn't send him a letter, so he drops it. Doesn't even show up in the Colorado Project.
Right.
But, you know, it makes you wonder if our military, and this isn't the only time this has happened, gives pilots the right and the order to fire on an unidentified flying object. Clearly, they think it physically exists because they're not telling them to fire at lights in the sky.
Right. Right. And so the question, well, there's a lot of questions raised, but... Well, I guess this would be the question. I would imagine that you came across other cases in which pilots were ordered to fire. It makes me think of Milton Torres or some others. Well, did you come across other reports like that?
Actually, the one that I mentioned is the only one we talk about other than Mildred Torres, which you mentioned, and we don't have him in the book, actually, because that occurred in Great Britain, and we don't actually, and we didn't have any documents on,
right,
on the case. This one we have in the book because we have the tape recording of Roy Craig, one of the Colorado Project scientists, interviewing this Boeing engineer. So that's why we have that one, because we have the evidence.
So as a researcher, though, do you feel that this probably wasn't the first time that it seems to be a fairly consistent story?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they did it on a regular basis, but I'm sure that there were multiple times, other times that we've never heard about, where they ordered aircraft to fire on these.
And so I wonder, and I you probably wonder this, but do you think they ever hit one?
No, I don't think they. I don't think they would have ever hit one.
Yeah, and I could see that some people may disagree, but in other stories, and I'm sure you have these, where at least military was told to chase them or to follow them, you know, they shoot off at really quick speeds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely we have multiple cases where the military has ordered jets to intercept without saying fire on them. That happened in Washington, D.C. That happened in Belgium with the F-16s on the triangle that was there. I can't recall the other cases. I think, but I do believe we have a couple of other cases where, the Mantell case, for example, where his plane crashed. That was a case where he was trying to intercept. Another one that's really interesting is the one, I believe it was either in this is either North or South Dakota, where basically a B-52. Strategic nuclear bomber was coming back in. It was Minot, South Dakota. And he was going to land. And they told him not to land, but to continue to fly around because it was a UFO that was being seen from the ground, and they wanted him to fly near it. That's a case that we talk about briefly, and also the case in Iran. And, I believe that was 1976 or 72. That case we talk about also, where Iranian pilots were ordered to intercept a UFO that was seen there.
And often it's like this cat and dog type of thing where, and the object just takes off quickly.
Oh yeah. And it's just gone. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, same thing with the, Alaska airliner in 1986, I believe. The jet, the FAA had the jet fly a 360 around Fairbanks to see if the object would disappear. Yeah, I'm sure they did that to say, okay, maybe is this guy looking at Venus or the moon or something? And no, it doesn't. You know, it stays with him the whole time, and it's picked up on radar. So, yeah, it's like it's like whatever this phenomenon is, it's able to do whatever it wants when it wants to.
Now, I'm sure your book doesn't end in 69 and then pick up later again with Stephenville. So even though, you know, in the surface, the Air Force is saying they don't investigate sightings anymore, I would imagine you found documents to show that there were some investigations after 69.
Yeah, what we show is there were things that happened after 69, and it makes you know that there had to be plenty of others, because it was very difficult to find the information on anything after 69, after 1969. But, you know, one of the first ones we talked to is one that Barry Greenwood talks about, that happened in the United States in the early 70s up in the area of Maine, where think of Loring Air Force Base, where there was some unknown object that went over the base, and somehow someone obtained the information on this through a FOIA. It's documented very well in Barry Greenwood's book called Clear Intent. But that was an example, right? Because the Project Blue Book no longer existed. Yet here were all these government documents about this event that occurred in 1975 over Loring Air Force Base in Maine. And then the case up in Iran with the F-4 Phantom jets. That was a case, again, that someone happened to get a hold of a Department of Defense document that talked about it. But it was nothing that the government, you know, that you could easily get. You just have to get lucky and find those things. Same thing with the Alaska airliner in 1986. The military actually asked the FAA if they wanted them to send up intercept pilots, you know, F-16s to intercept, you know, whatever the object was next to the Japanese airliner.
Wow.
And it was the Japanese airliner pilot that said, no, I don't need any, you know, F-16 sent up.
Wow. So how many cases did you find from 69 on?
It's a limited number of cases from 69 on. There's probably maybe 8 cases that, you know, we were able to find documentation on to show that, you know, the government was still reacting to it.
Wow.
One of the cases we talk about also that occurs after that time frame is Roswell. And the reason we talk about that is not whether or not Roswell really occurred or didn't occur. We talk about it because the Air Force reacted to everyone's concerns about Roswell and came out with what we believe were bogus reports, the Roswell report and their other report, Roswell report case closed, where they create these dummies that they said were what people were seeing. Mm-hmm. And those gummies didn't even exist back then. So it was like we identify that because it gives you an example of how the government reacts to the phenomenon. In this case, they're reacting to how the public's reacting to the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So,
and, mm-hmm. yeah. Then that's the last case that we talk about. From there, we go into other countries' histories.
Uh-huh. So I guess it comes down to, what are some of the other countries you cover before I get into
this? Okay, sure. Let me tell you about some of the countries, two of the countries we don't cover, for example, are England and Canada.
Okay.
And the reason we don't cover them is
you don't like them?
Right. We don't like them. They speak the wrong kind of language.
They talk funny. Just kidding.
They talk something called the Queen's English.
Yeah.
No, actually, we don't really go into those simply because they're very close military allies of the United States, especially Canada, as well as England. And the way they treat the UFO phenomenon is the same way the United States did.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't see any value in going through theirs. What we did do is we showed some other countries to give a flavor of how countries that aren't necessarily close allies of the United States, how they dealt with the phenomenon. And, for example, we go through the history of the Sweden's experience with the phenomenon.
Oh, interesting.
And one of the interesting things about the Swedish experience is that the military worked closely with the civilian agencies.
Hmm.
Unlike, the U.S. experience.
Yeah, they don't work with us.
Yeah. And we talk about the Australian incident simply because there's some really interesting ones in Australia in one point in time where there was almost a nuclear war that occurred.
Wow.
And that one's written by Bill Chalker. It's real interesting. And
in other words, like they were mistaking unidentified objects for enemy ships and so they were about ready to push some buttons?
Right. There was a concern about, and I don't want to get this one wrong because this is, Bill's kind of chapter that he wrote, but there's an incident where a nuclear alert goes into play. And at the same time there's a nuclear alert, there's these UFO sightings. So there was this concern that, could the UFOs send the nuclear alert to a higher level?
Hmm.
And the initial nuclear alert occurred because of a situation that had occurred in Israel.
Oh, okay.
So it was a Middle Eastern thing that initiated it all. But then the UFOs being in the area at the time of that just worsened the potential for a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Spanish chapter is very interesting. It goes into basically how Spain turned over all of their UFO files to a civilian organization and worked with them on it. But my favorite chapter is France. And I guess the reason I really like that chapter, other than I wrote it, is of all the countries, France is the only one that took the UFO phenomenon out of the military arena of national security. Because it doesn't matter what country you're talking about, if your military organization is dealing with the UFO phenomenon, they're going to deal with it from the aspect of national security, because that's what they do. They protect mm-hmm. a nation. Well, that's the way the French started off. But then a guy by the name of Dr. Claude Poher convinced the head of the authorities there, once they realized it was not a national security issue, that it should be turned over to their space agency. And so GPAN was made a sub-organization under the French National Space Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are probably the only country of which I'm aware that they actually use scientists and tried their best to use scientific methods to analyze the phenomena. I mean, they did some great work on a case in Trans-en-Provence where they took both soil samples, vegetation samples. And so that's really a chapter of, I think, how it would be nice if that's the way the United States approached it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's exciting about the French. And I know some people like to make fun of the French. But as far as UFOs go, it's so exciting that it's their equivalent to NASA that's doing this investigation and taking it very seriously. And even in a recent analysis, had said they weren't sure what the root of the phenomena is, and they even went on to say they aren't ruling out the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Right. The French are actually pretty open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's and they, like you said, they do take it seriously. And just to show how seriously, I give an example in that chapter of a guy who plays a hoax. And the way the French operate, the gendarmes work with the National Space Agency. So their initial investigator is their gendarmes. And the gendarmes, for the people who don't know, are more than just police. They're more equivalent to our FBI, except they're in uniform. It's their national police force. So this guy pulls a hoax, and as soon as they figure it out, they arrest him and haul him off.
Wow.
So, they do take it seriously. So mm-hmm. You don't have people playing hoaxes in France. You don't have people flying Chinese lanterns and claiming their UFOs.
Right.
And, the last one I'll mention real quick, Alejandro, mm-hmm. which I really like, is the case in Belgium.
Right.
And we also talk about Russia, Brazil, and Belgium very briefly. But Belgium, I really like because of that triangle incident. And, that photo, whether that photo is real or not, I don't know. But that's not, to me, what's important about the case. What's really the more important part is the number of police that saw this object, and they've just tracked it as it flew across at very slow speeds across their country.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had over 250 witnesses, and of those 250 witnesses, around 16 to 20 were policemen
mm-hmm.
who were in patrol cars tracking this. It's like, well, how do you explain that?
Yeah, several sightings of this object from police and others, and that's why I'm really excited to have at my upcoming conference General DeBrower. Of course, you and I got to see him speak in San Jose a few years ago, and his talk is wonderful because he goes step by step through all of these sightings, jets being scrambled, all of these different incidents. And you get to see this incredible, like Japan or something, they took this serious investigative stance. I mean, they took it very seriously, and you get to see their investigation step by step and what had happened, and it is extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. I mean these policemen, at one point, they follow this craft to a lake where it sits there for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only at about 500 feet. They estimate 100-foot wingspan. So it's not like you're seeing a light in the sky, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what? I mean, either they saw it or they've gone wacko, one of the two.
Right.
You can't say they misidentified something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really impressive. I love that. So that's going to be very exciting to see him talking, and he'll be able to speak on the photo that you're talking about to give us an update on his feelings on the legitimacy of the photo. But further, even if he feels it is hoaxed, like you said, to go on to demonstrate the abundance of evidence in that wave of sightings. So very exciting stuff. I'm really excited about the book. Getting back to the U.S. So you've talked about how there were investigations. The United States has taken this serious, even after 1969. So what are your feelings for behind the scenes? Of course, they have what they tell the public, but behind the scenes you have people ordering pilots to go shoot them down, and maybe some incidents, but at least to intercept objects in others. Do you feel there is this grand conspiracy behind the scene, or is it kind of more informal and there's one-offs type of situations happening, or are you still just as mystified as to what might be going on as you were when you started this project?
Well, you know, Alejandro, I don't see things in black and white, so I always consider everything as a possibility. Mm-hmm. It may be 1% likely, but everything's a possibility. But to me, I don't think that there's an overriding conspiracy of any type. I really don't. From when you read the history of it, there may be groups, you know, here and there that had some information or were collecting it, or they tracked and followed the information, kind of like what John Alexander points out in his book. And so they may know some things, but I don't think there's any overriding group that is a constant thread through history. And this group, you know, this group from 1940 to today has always had the information and controlled it. Mm-hmm. I think it's piecemeal. It's been in different organizations. I honestly think that there's two basic driving forces. One is that the military has no idea what the phenomenon is, and as a result, they don't want to deal with something they can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, and I don't know how this has happened, but it's almost like there's this psychological thing where people don't even want to talk about it or even consider it as a possibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the government,
right?
It's like, don't talk to me about it. Are you crazy? Well, what are you talking about?
Right. And we see that over and over again where military witnesses say that they never reported these things officially because of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm just within the last year, I was talking to a guy who'd come out of the military and was flying one of these, I can't remember the exact name, it's an Orion-type craft that's used over the Gulf of Mexico to keep an eye on, you know, aliens coming into the United States or things going, you know, or smugglers or drug runners, all that kind of thing. And he had... This guy, I won't go into him, but he had two experiences in the crew that was with him where they picked these objects up with their infrared cameras, with their regular cameras. And so after he described all this to me, I said, so when you got back, did you report it? And what did your, you know, commanding officer say? And he goes, no, we didn't report it. I said, why wouldn't you report it? Well, because they would have figured we're crazy, and so we didn't report it. I mean, it's just like that's the way it always is.
Yeah, I heard from some guy who claimed, and he seemed to be a very credible individual. He was retired not for very long, I don't think, in his early 60s. And he came to a conference out in the middle of the San Luis Valley that I was at. And he told me, he took me aside, you know, one night, and we were sitting in the campfire because this was out where a conference, which is kind of fun, you camp there too. And he said he used to work at NORAD, and that whenever they saw something that was unexplainable, they knew wasn't theirs, they called it a Section 8. And they didn't talk about it. It was kind of this unwritten rule, you don't talk about it. And that's hilarious, because, of course, if people remember, and I don't know if this is true, but it has a ring of truth, partially because if people remember what a Section 8 is, you know, this is what Corporal Klinger was trying to get in MASH by wearing women's clothes. He said, you know, always, give me a Section 8 to show he was crazy to get kicked out of the military for being crazy. And that's what they call the Section 8. So kind of funny.
Yeah. It's, you remember Hogan's, did you ever see Hogan's Heroes?
Uh-huh.
Remember Sergeant Schultz?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever he would, you know, remember. Whenever something was going on, he'd go, I see nothing. I know nothing. I hear nothing.
Right.
It's that same thing. It's
yeah.
like...
There, you would imagine there's also a strain, kind of like the strain who started MUFON, engineers who, and maybe that's the inspiration behind some of these guys who had ordered them to be shot down, who are so interested in the technology that they want to get their hands on it.
It's possible, but, you know, my gut...
Not to say that they have been able to.
Right. I think even if they had their hands on it, they'd have no idea what they had.
Yeah, they wouldn't know what to do with it.
But probably about as likely as Columbus could figure out what a silicon chip does.
Mm-hmm. I love your example of that, too, because we were talking about this the other day. And I'll let you explain it. And one of the first difficulties they would have with a silicon chip back then.
Oh, yeah. I was saying you don't even have to go back to Columbus's day. You could just go back 150 years to, like, the year 1850. And you could give them a silicon chip. And, you know, they could see, oh, that looks like this is probably aluminum on the top, but we're not sure. It looks like solid aluminum. Well, electron microscopes didn't exist, so there's no way they could even see the definition of the aluminum lines that exist on a silicon chip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let alone figure out what this thing did.
Right.
And then, you know, as soon as they probably put a drop of acid on it, see if it's really aluminum, of course, then they would have destroyed it, chip. So,
and
you know, the idea that we could, I mean, 150 years ago, we couldn't reverse engineer the technology that we have today. There's no way we're going to reverse engineer technology of someone 1,000 years more advanced than us.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that's what it is, who knows?
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much. I want to talk about, because we're pretty much out of time, when is the book available?
It should be available within the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
So keep checking on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it should be available soon.
MUFON, and it's being published by Anomalous Books, not like Anomalous, Anomalous.
Right.
So it ends in L-I-S-T, books.com.
Patrick Weege
mm-hmm.
is our publisher.
So you can find it there. And, of course, there'll be links at MUFON.com, and I'll be certainly spreading the word also.
Well, thanks for talking to me this evening, Alejandro. As usual, it's great talking to you again. Look forward to seeing you again before long.
Thanks. It was great to have you on again. I'm so excited about this work. Congratulations to you and all the authors on finishing this book. I think it's going to be a really important piece of work. All right. Thank you to Robert so much for being on the show. And this, if you go to that anomalousbooks.com and you go to the coming soon, UFOs and Government, a Historical Inquiry, and you will see all the authors: Michael Swartz, Robert Powell, Klaus Vaughn, Vicente Juan Ballester Olmos, Bill Tulker, Barry Greenwood, Richard Deems, John Aldrich, and Steve Purcell. So you may recognize some of those names. Thank you so much for joining me once again. We will have some more excitement next week, so be sure to be there. Talk to you next week, people. Until then, enjoy some music by Two Earth Minutes.